Good evening and welcome to tonight's special meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Tad Tobey. I'm president of the CRED Foundation, chairman of Tobey Philanthropies, member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listeners on radio and television, and we invite everyone to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I also wish to thank, on behalf of all of us, the CRED Foundation and the Bank of America for their generous sponsorship of tonight's program. It is a daunting assignment to introduce one of the greatest Americans as well as one of the world's great statesmen of this era. George Shultz's achievements in service to his country, to the academic community, and to American enterprise are beyond legend. He has served four U.S. presidents in positions which have included Secretary of Labor, Secretary of the Treasury, Director of the Office of Management and Budget, Chairman of the Council of Economic Policy, and finally, as Secretary of State under President Ronald Reagan. A complete biography of this remarkable man is beyond the time limitations given us for this program. However, no introduction of this very special individual would be complete without note of his deep love of country, his unquenchable patriotism, his compassion for the less fortunate, his intellectual brilliance, and his extraordinary leadership qualities. From his days in presidential cabinets to his current advisory role as one of America's most highly regarded statesmen, George Shultz has always conducted himself based on his belief that government gets its legitimacy from its people and that strength and diplomacy hand in hand represent the keys to freedom. And now it is my privilege and singular honor to introduce our celebrated guest, Secretary George Shultz. George? Thanks, George. Okay.
I always consider it a special privilege to appear at the Commonwealth Club. You can go all over the world, and you won't find a forum that can measure up to this club, what it does day in, day out, year in, year out, in educating us and giving us a way of talking about the things we consider important. So I consider it always a privilege to come here. Well, my first proposition is this. We live at a time of unprecedented promise. Freer and more open economic and political systems of governance are gaining ground, and the evidence is clear that these developments lead to more prosperous and hopeful lives. So it's a terrifically hopeful moment in the history of the world. The second proposition is that terrorist attacks on civilian targets in other countries remind us of our own 9/11, that a war is going on, and that we in the United States are very much involved. Attention is focused on Iraq for understandable reasons, but the threat reaches far beyond that. Insecurity is the enemy of the promise and the hope. So we must focus on the threat and deal with it effectively. In my own thinking about the war, I find it useful to keep three ideas in mind. The first is derived from the great seal of our republic. In the center is an eagle. In one talon, the eagle holds an olive branch, and the eagle is looking at the olive branch to show that the United States will always seek peace. In the other talon, the eagle is holding arrows, to show that the United States understands that you have to be strong if you're going to be effective in seeking peace. The fact that there are 13 arrows shows how ancient this idea is in our history. So strength and diplomacy are not alternatives. Strength and diplomacy are complements. They go together, and you do best when you work them together. People forget that too easily. Next, I think it's very important as we proceed in this war to emphasize that political openness and increases in income per capita, that is, prosperity, that come from use of the market, recognition of private property, and the rule of law go together. Democracy more likely takes hold when earned incomes are rising, and markets flourish best in open political environments. So as we work toward more openness, more responsiveness in government, more democracy, we need to work also on the economic side, because these things, just as strength and diplomacy go together, political and economic progress go together. Now my third idea in this fifth point, really, third in what to do about it, is that we need to recognize that this war has already gone through two phases, and we're now in a third phase. Each one of these phases has different characteristics, so it's important to recognize what they are. This third phase will be with us a long time and is the long war that's been identified by the President and others even shortly after 9/11. During the first phase of this war, going back certainly to the 1970s, we were essentially passive. We were hit by increasing numbers of terrorist acts, but though there was a gradual buildup of concern, we did nothing significant in response to these attacks. Then September 11th woke America up. We reacted powerfully, putting in place a different philosophy and taking a great variety of actions to implement that philosophy. We are now 4.5 years away from that calamitous event. The war continues, but the juices of reaction to 9/11 have subsided. We must now realize that the job in the third phase of the war, necessary if we are to be successful, is to put our efforts on a sustainable basis, gaining broad support at home and abroad. As in the Cold War, public understanding and support will be as crucial as persistent pressure and the will to win. So that's basically the outline of my talk. Now, first, let me make a few comments about the first phase, the passive phase. The war started a long time ago, although we did not recognize its nature until recently. We witnessed the assassination of Israeli athletes at the Olympic Games in Munich in 1972, the assault on our embassy in Tehran with Americans taken hostage in 1979, the assassination of President Sadat in 1981, the car bomb that killed 243 Marines in Lebanon in 1983, the attack on the World Trade Center in 1993, the bombing of our embassies in Africa, and the attack on the USS Cole in the late 1990s. We made no serious response to any of these bloody assaults. In the Reagan, Bush 41, and Clinton years, we had hit back once or twice using airstrikes and cruise missiles. The enemy was not impressed. By the mid-1990s, we knew about Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. Just as Hitler laid out his plans in Mein Kampf, Osama bin Laden made no secret of his program. As in the case of Hitler, his announced objectives were not taken seriously enough. There was, however, a building concern about escalating terrorism. As a hawk on the subject in the Reagan era, my comments in a 1984 speech were, I might say, nervously received. I said then that we must reach a consensus in this country that our responses should go beyond passive defense to consider means of active prevention, preemption, and retaliation. The question posed by terrorism involves our intelligence capability, the doctrine under which we would employ force, and most important of all, our public's attitude toward this challenge. Our nation cannot summon the will to act without firm public understanding and support. And then something that's been quoted a lot, we cannot allow ourselves to become the Hamlet of nations, worrying endlessly over whether and how to respond. There were also responses from the UN Security Council and some resolutions that clearly expressed the Council's condemnation of terrorism. Looking back at all those terrorist attacks in the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s, we could see that our enemy targeted every aspect of the international system: tourism, commerce, air travel, world finance, the United Nations, embassies, the commitment to the principle of diplomatic immunity, the sovereign and territorial integrity of states. This was Islamism, a radical aberrational deviation from Islam, with an ideology that set itself violently against every element of the international state system, the century-old basis for a cooperative world order. Nevertheless, in the first phase of this war, the terrorists had a completely free rein, with no real effort made to carry the fight to them, let alone defend ourselves aggressively. What can we learn from this experience? First, passivity does not lead to a cessation of attacks. On the contrary, passivity only encourages our adversaries to believe that they can do as they choose without consequences to themselves. The terrorists were getting a free ride from us, even as their attacks grew greater in frequency and devastating power. Second, the concept of law enforcement, while important to maintain, is not nearly sufficient in an age of attacks usually planned and orchestrated from other countries that have devastating consequences for us. Third, the attacks came with little or no warning, highlighting the importance of vastly improved intelligence capabilities. We learned that we must respond, and our responses must be effective. So now I turn to what I've called the reactive phase. The second phase began on September 11, 2001. Americans woke up. I was reminded of Admiral Yamamoto, who led the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor and knew something about the United States. After the attack, he said, "We have awakened a sleeping giant and instilled in it a terrible resolve." Osama bin Laden also awakened a sleeping giant. We began as a people and a government to recognize the extent of the danger, to pull together our facts and assessments, to describe the nature of the challenge as best we could. Still, we were hesitant. The president rightly visited a mosque to show that we did not regard this as a religious war with the Muslim world. Did not know what to call it, even though we knew that as long ago as 1997, Osama bin Laden had issued a declaration of war on America and pronounced it every Muslim's religious duty to kill any and every American citizen. The president called it a war on terror. He would later say that we were at war with Taliban-like radicals. Late last year, the president decided to tell it like it is, a war waged by terror-using Islamists. In his State of the Union message in January 2006, President Bush said, "One of the main sources of reaction and opposition to the spread of freedom is radical Islam, the perversion by a few of a noble faith into an ideology of terror and death. Terrorists like bin Laden are serious about mass murder, and all of us must take their declared intentions seriously." So we changed our mindset quickly. Having identified the enemy, we changed our mindset quickly after 9/11, switching to a war mentality. We understood that we would have to use force, and we summoned the will to do so. In war, you have an offense and a defense. You harden targets at home, and you use intelligence aggressively to find out about plots so that you can prevent them from taking place. You have an offense designed to take the action to the enemy and put the fight in their territory. The initial action in Afghanistan was widely supported, and we had the good sense early on to put a credible Afghan face on everything taking place. Afghanistan, a failed state seized in the 1990s by the Taliban and then commandeered by Al-Qaeda, has been returned to legitimacy as a sovereign state in the international system. Let us not kid ourselves. We and the Afghans have a big job to do on the economic as well as the political front. But the Taliban and Al-Qaeda though they continue to cause trouble, are remnants of what they were. Our NATO allies have committed themselves to take over most of the security functions from American forces and increasingly are on the ground and engaged. Iraq is a different case, complex, difficult, and at once discouraging and promising. Sectarian issues are fanned by violence fomented by Iraq's enemies and designed to create the constant danger of escalation. At the same time, there are many signs of progress which themselves put the objectives of the terrorists at risk. Progress is necessary for success and is therefore a prime target. The stakes could not be higher for them and for us. So I'll say more about Iraq and the Middle East in a moment. In addition to the actions in Afghanistan and Iraq, the idea of using force to prevent attacks, particularly in the light of the destructive power of weapons of mass destruction, became a formal part of national security policy in the September 2002 National Security Strategy of the United States. Our reaction to 9/11, then, produced many changes, but two big ones are identified here. Our adversary has been clearly identified, a radical brand of Islam ready to use the murderous weapon of terrorism. And our mindset has changed from passive reliance on law enforcement as our means of response to the emergence of a war mentality with an offense and a defense and a willingness to use force to prevent attacks on us and our allies. So now phase three, creating a sustained effort. This is the hardest part. A lot has happened since 9/11, and a lot of progress has been made. Even as we reacted to 9/11, we could see that this war would go on for a long time. We are gradually moving toward emphasis on the sustainability necessary for victory. So let us now review some of the things that have happened already and that need to be extended and sustained. First, intelligence. We see the profound importance of an intense and sustained effort to improve our intelligence capability. The failure to find stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq has highlighted this necessity. So, too, has retrospective analysis of the gaps in intelligence collections and the misreadings in our intelligence analysis in the period just before 9/11. Can't anyone recognize the dots, let alone connect them? The task is not easy. Major surprises dot the landscape of the 20th century. There's a fascinating book entitled Surprises that catalogs a huge number of really big-time surprises, despite the vaunted intelligence agencies of British, Russian, Israeli, ourselves, and so on. So it's not an easy task. Remember Pearl Harbor. But even more importantly, we are coming to realize that ever since the Vietnam Watergate era, we ourselves had, piece by piece, denigrated, dismantled, or impeded our intelligence capabilities to a dangerous extent. We must do a better job. The need is clearly recognized, and a remedial action is apparently underway. I say apparently, I don't know, but I hope they're doing something. Multiple sources and competitors. I'm not too impressed with adding more layers, frankly. In business, when you have too many, you start taking layers out and you're more successful. We put layers in, but I hope they're good people and I hope they're going to get somewhere. Multiple sources and competitive analysis are among the watchwords. I'm most impressed with the recognized need for capable and creative people. That's the key. Capable, creative people. And a realization of the importance of open information. Too much in the intelligence business, people think the most important information is something you collected clandestinely, when usually it's what's open that's the most important, and you've got to realize that. Be in no doubt, however, the future of preventive action requires confidence that we have an intelligence on which we can rely. I believe an additional step is needed to help take advantage as much as we can of everything that is openly available, and to do it in a way that improves our ability to understand what that information means. We should increase, as I believe Secretary Rice is trying to do, our Foreign Service resources and establish new small consulates in key places around the world. We must recognize security concerns, as the recent loss of a Foreign Service officer in Karachi demonstrates. We need savvy people who speak the language and who come to know what is openly available. Call them diplomatic boots on the ground. Certainly people at the center must be the ones who put the pieces together. But we need more people out around the world who understand what the individual pieces mean. Let me turn to the subject of finances. An aggressive effort continues with leadership from the United States and the Treasury Department to track down the sources of finance for the terrorists to try to dry up their access to money. That financial effort has a direct impact, and it also has the indirect effect of putting potential financiers on notice that they are being watched. Tracking the money also helps us understand our adversary by learning who is talking to whom and which groups are involved with each other, and even to identify individuals or groups of terrorists. All this is taking place as an international effort and must be sustained that way for the effort to succeed. We must curtail the finances of the terrorists. This is very tough at a time when oil prices are high and staggering revenues are flowing into countries that are clear enemies. My friend Jim Woolsey says this is the first war in which we're financing both sides. For these and many, 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 many other reasons, we should learn how to use less oil. I think in my previous time here at the Commonwealth Club, I went over that, and it's even more obvious now. And a major national effort is called for. I was so pleased to hear the President of the State of the Union message say, America is addicted to oil, which is often imported from unstable parts of the world. So tonight I announce the Advanced Energy Initiative to push for breakthroughs in two vital areas, to change how we power our homes and offices, and to change how we power our automobiles. So sustained work on finance is essential to success in this area, and learning how to use less oil will help enormously. The effort to find ways to use less oil needs to recognize that as these efforts succeed, the price of oil may decline. Sustainability means alternatives must meet a tougher market test than posed by a price of oil that is high. Now I want to talk about the next point in the sustainable effort to win, and that is the stopping of proliferation of devastating weapons. The Pakistan-based worldwide black market in nuclear weapons components and know-how run by AQ Khan has been uncovered and eliminated, an intelligence and diplomatic triumph, and a demonstration of willpower to confront Pakistan authorities even as we depend on their help. Our willingness to use force after 9/11 also influenced President Musharraf to come quickly to the side of the United States against the terrorists. Without our action, Pakistan might well have fallen under Islamist terrorist rule, with Pakistan's nuclear weapons arsenal under their control. Continued vigilance is essential. Libya, in the context of all this, made the momentous decision to give up all its weapons of mass destruction, a triumph of intelligence and diplomacy backed by strength, including the preventive seizure of a vessel from North Korea. The amounts of material turned over to us far exceeded what we or the rest of the world believed Libya to possess, another spur to our need to improve our intelligence capabilities. With its decision, Libya now has a chance to rejoin the responsible international community. The decision would not have been made if U.S. strength and diplomacy had not impressed upon Libya the reality that any outlaw regime that attempts to gain weapons of mass destruction is on a losing path. Iran, as North Korea, now poses a great threat as it seeks to gain nuclear weapons capability. With U.S. help, the European Union and the International Atomic Energy Agency are actively engaged in the effort to turn Iran back from this course. All five U.N. Security Council permanent members voted in the IAEA to refer the Iran problem to the Security Council. What further action will be taken remains uncertain. Just as France declares without qualification that Iran seeks a nuclear weapon, and the IAEA reports on multiple Iranian deceptions, China is negotiating a further deal for Iranian oil. So it's going to be hard to bring this in. Iran seems to be convinced that its actions, as in restarting its enrichment facilities, will have no adverse consequences. They see no strength behind the diplomacy. We must be ready to summon the will and persuade others to join us, to use economic and political strength and ultimately force to deal with this situation if multilateral diplomacy and collective security are to be credible. Beyond the problems presented by Iran and North Korea, an energetic and creative effort is needed in the area of nuclear weaponry. In addition to nonproliferation efforts currently underway, we should consider promoting the establishment of identified places that can enrich uranium. They could be operated by the countries involved with an international presence and a statement that any country wishing to have peaceful nuclear power can get enriched uranium at a reasonable price. This is a big deal if something like this can be established. The objective is to get control of the enrichment process on a world scale. Efforts in this direction are underway, and they deserve support. Countries in the Middle East have fertility rates that put their populations out of control, with huge numbers of young people who have nothing to do and whose lives are detached from the kind of reality that the act of working imparts. One of the reasons for this is the culture of denying women responsible and productive roles in the way society is operated. These regimes need to change, and the effort to bring more economic and political openness is a critical ingredient in this third stage of the war. Indeed, all across the Middle East, there are signs that the U.S. conviction that the region, beset by dysfunction and the pathology of terrorism, has to be transformed, is having an effect. The Syrian regime has been unmasked as the oppressor of Lebanon. Its troops have been pulled out of Lebanese territory, and its ruler, Bashar Assad, is feeling increasing international pressure over his role in mafia-style murders and intimidation in Lebanon. Lebanon has been set on the road, no doubt a road made more difficult by the armed, supported by Iran, presence of Hezbollah to regaining its sovereign statehood. This has been a goal of the United States ever since Syrian troops occupied Lebanon in the late 1970s. Now, with the United States and France cooperating on a remarkable UN Security Council resolution, Lebanon has hope again. Lebanese leaders have said openly that this chance to restore Lebanon's sovereignty could not have happened if the United States had not gone into Iraq to depose Saddam Hussein and lay the foundation for Iraq itself to regain legitimacy in the international state system. There have been small but significant steps toward opening the political system in Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the Gulf states. For example, women can now vote and hold office in Kuwait. May not sound like much to us. It's a big deal over there. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict has passed a turning point with Israel's unilateral ending of its occupation of Gaza and the withdrawal of its troops. The Palestinians now face a defining moment. Can they put in place a government able to maintain security, stop corruption, and credibly continue peace talks with Israel? To date, the answer is no. Gaza is in chaos, and an Islamist terrorist faction dedicated to Israel's obliteration has won an election. What will come next? Will the moment come when the Palestinian people face up to the reality that their use of terror leads to misery and hopelessness? Will they create conditions that make it possible to achieve a two-state solution for the conflict? Meanwhile, Israel is looking to its own security with its policy of disengagement. The key to further develop positive developments in the Middle East and more broadly is Iraq. It's critical. All the possible good things can go by the wayside very easily. Can Iraq become a stable country with a representative government and an improving and healthy economy? A severe test is before us. As the Financial Times editorialized, after the provocative bombing of the Al-Askari shrine, quote, Iraq's future hit by a perfectly aimed blow. This was the ultimate provocateur of civil war. There was an eruptive reaction, but now a counter-reaction seems to be taking hold as leaders and their followers see that the terrorists gain from the abyss of civil war. Sunni leaders must realize by now that they cannot win by violence, and Shia leaders that they cannot govern without an inclusive pattern of governance. An odd balance of blocking power may lead to the desperately needed government of national unity. With due recognition of all the clear problems, Iraqi political leaders have that chance to form a government regarded as legitimate, derived from elections. Such a government can release the major potential of the economy by suppressing the sabotage of terrorists. We took far too long to put an Iraqi face on what we are doing in that beleaguered country. But Iraqis now have clear responsibilities. Our presence is there to support constructive efforts in that collaborative effort for success. Meanwhile, we now know that a huge number of documents produced by Saddam Hussein's regime were captured. While these documents, for reasons hard to understand, have not been aggressively translated and exploited, enough has been done to show that in Iraq there were in existence three training centers for terrorists with approximately some 8,000 or so trainees. We must aggressively exploit these documents so that we can identify who the trainees are, learn the methods they have been trained to use and their connections to other countries. And to the extent that these terrorists are operating in Iraq today, do everything possible to get them out of circulation before they go elsewhere. The Middle East always captures the world's attention, never more so than now. The problems have never been more clear. The stakes have never been higher. And with all due recognition to the difficulties, the possibilities for positive developments have never been greater. To succeed, we need efforts that are sustained, combining diplomacy with strength of all kinds and building on the interplay of open political and economic systems. I have a fascinating lengthy session here entitled The Need to Communicate with the Islamic World, and it builds on what we have gotten from the study of all of the archival material in Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty that we have at the Hoover Institution. And we drew lessons from that and then had another conference with people from the Islamic world seeing what lessons can we learn that we could use. And I have spelled this all out in fascinating detail, but I'm going to skip it all in the interest of leaving some time for questions. Maybe somebody will ask me a question about that. So I have a final section entitled The Way Ahead. The Islamist terrorist cause has been damaged extensively. The areas of the Middle East that served as safe havens and training grounds, Afghanistan, Yemen, and we now know Saddam's Iraq, have been taken away from them. They must not be allowed to gain control of Iraq. Their financial sources have been tracked down, and that effort continues. No longer can they raise support from around the world and move money across borders and continents as they wish. An all-out effort must be sustained to use less oil. And Al-Qaeda, as the central coordinating base for a globe-spanning terrorist network, is no more. The cells now are more like independent players in a loose array of Islamist activists. The dispersion raises a new set of challenges in the war, but the change is an undeniable advance on the movement as it was developing before 9/11. But our defenses must continue to be hardened. Our borders and ports remain because of their vast extent, possible avenues for terrorists to damage our economy and to gain entrance to our country. The silver lining in the Dubai controversy may be needed improvements in security at our ports. And we need to further enlarge and deepen our intelligence cooperation and exchanges with other services and countries around the world. Our collection techniques gain sustainability from well-understood and secretly conducted forms of oversight. Above all, we must not let up on the reality that we are at war and will continue to be so for some time to come. Some commentators have noted that the length of time from 9/11 to today is longer than World War II. This is the wrong analogy. What we face is more akin to the decades-long struggle of the Cold War. And being at war, we must retain the option and the will to use force, even as we pair that option with intensive diplomacy. The American eagle and the great seal must continue to look toward the olive branch, but just as importantly, must keep a powerful cluster of arrows in its grasp. One final point, perhaps the most important. The world has never been in a situation of greater promise than now for improvements in the level of income and quality of life in countries that have been mired in poverty. Look at China. Look at India. The information age, combined with a realization of the magic of the marketplace, are creating new opportunities for growth and rising standards of life. We can rally people all over the world to this banner, the benefits of economic and political openness and freedom. The terrorists must not be allowed to abort this opportunity. We will win this war against them, basically, by positive action that helps people see improvements in the way they live. Thank you.
What a tour de force. Please join me in thanking Secretary Shultz again for an extraordinary speech. I'm Elizabeth Sherwood Randall. I'm a senior research scholar at Stanford University and a member of the Board of Governors of the Commonwealth Club. And I am awed to be given the opportunity to moderate the questions and answers tonight. I served as a mere intern.
Elizabeth, I know you too well. You are not awed.
I am telling the truth. I was a mere intern in your State Department. And to stand before you tonight to ask you, I feel humbled. You have shaped our era, as this plaque is inscribed. And the questions that have been submitted tonight reflect the huge richness and wealth of your knowledge and experience. And to begin, several people have asked, would you please elaborate for us on the issue of how we can communicate more effectively with the Islamic world, because that is one of the huge challenges that we face going forward.
Well, I think the reactions to Danish cartoons show us that there's a real problem out there. They show us the dangerous tendencies also of authoritarian regimes such as Syria and Iran to use any excuse like that to fan protests as a way to divert attention from their own deep deficiencies. But I think they also underline this other reality that we need to do a much better job of communicating with the world of Islam. And I mentioned the work that we've done down at Stanford's Hoover Institution on this. So I'll read out these lessons. Number one, create a realistic sense of mission. While radical Islam is, in a sense, the problem, the mission needs to focus on helping what may be called mainstream Muslims to address the issues and take on the radicals. In the end, it is the Islamic community itself that needs to engage in this battle, and we need to encourage that effort. We also know that radical Islamists cannot function without a surrounding population that acquiesces in or can be frightened into supporting and not opposing them. So our effort has to be to dry up the sea of support in which the terrorists swim. That is the mission. I think it's very important in this to focus on a mission that you are identified with and you can sustain. So second, study the target audiences carefully. We will need to differentiate among them. Words like Arabs or Muslims are deceptive because they conceal immense variety. Above all, pay attention to women, because in some countries they are kept out of everyday life. They have huge amounts of time to watch TV at home, where the morals police can't get at them. Women's content program is essential. Something similar, but with very different content, should be designed for another vast audience, unemployed males who sit around at the corner coffee houses all day. While the broadcasters will need to undertake studies themselves, they will need a lot of help. Unfortunately, proficiency in languages and efforts at area studies have declined in the United States. You remember in the Cold War period, and the radios encouraged this and helped get it going, we had at Stanford, at Harvard, at Columbia, and other places, Soviet studies groups, and people learned Russian. Condi Rice came out of that. That's how she learned Russian. But we're doing nothing in this area. What now passes for Mideast studies is not at all satisfactory. This means a major effort is necessary to encourage universities to undertake the scholarship in this field and to preserve and enhance all the ways in which the relevant languages are acquired by at least a reasonable number of Americans. Beyond the broad sweep of programs, such as those now sponsored by Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, they're working, special efforts should be made to target audiences in Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Iran, the Muslim communities in Western Europe, and possibly Pakistan. The history of radical movements shows that a high proportion of them originates in one form or another in these areas. Next, monitor what people say and be ready to interact. Much of what promises for commentary is altogether delusional. The Middle East, always remember, is the world's center for conspiracy theories. So some sort of counter-conspiracy desk is needed. If we are candid, open, and factually correct, we have a platform for countering some of this delusional talk. Much of the world of Islam has lost contact with reality, with the relationship of cause to effect. Reality needs to be a centerpiece of what we talk about. As part of the effort to connect people with reality, emphasis can be placed on the importance and the virtues of work, and concomitantly on the necessity of economic policies that lead to expanding economies. Among the problems, for example, in the European Muslim community is the fact that, as estimated for some urban areas, well over half the men of Moroccan origin over the age of 40 are living on welfare of one kind or another and have little expectation of working. Work connects people with reality. Put emphasis on the importance of education in the basic sense of the word. Too much of what passes for education in the world of Islam is simply propaganda and doesn't prepare people adequately for the tasks of work and the tasks of critical evaluation of what they're hearing. Special incentives might be developed to encourage people to learn the English language. No matter how impressive our effort, it will never succeed so long as Arab regimes continue to pump out tons of daily propaganda that over recent decades has driven ordinary Arabs into a perpetual condition of hyper-inflamed rage at outsiders, thus diverting the Arab population away from the regimes themselves. A concerted effort is needed on this problem. We need to maintain the pressure on the rulers of Qatar over the content and program of Al Jazeera. They own it and finance it. And by recent credible reports, the Emir of Qatar and his principal aides have been made to understand by the administration that they can't befriend us while sponsoring this brand of journalism. Consider including in our media strategy material that deftly shows that the Arab Islamic world needs to communicate with us in a far better way than they have done. Such material could show how awful they look to the world when they appear to be saturated in hate, self-pity, intolerance, and slaughter. Our news content must be candid, tuned to local audiences, and remorselessly accurate. Credibility will emerge, and credibility is the name of the game. Always, major events come along. The elections in Iraq, the Cedar Revolution, the tsunami tragedies, the earthquake around Kashmir. And credibility leads people to take our reports on such events as accurate. In the process, we discipline all the other efforts. So these are the kinds of things, it seems to me, ought to be the foundation of our effort to communicate with Islam, and we need to talk it around in the Senate and the House, and wind up not so much with bipartisan support, but kind of nonpartisan support, so that something like this can be sustained over a period of time as administrations come and go and the complexion of Congress changes. Nevertheless, you have something that can be continued, like the radios were.
I hope you've given that to Secretary Rice. We will trust you have. We have so many questions for you, but I'm going to move from the global to the local, and it takes us back to the global again. About a quarter of the cards that were written tonight are about the Dubai port contract question, and this reflects a community that has a major American port in its midst. People want to know how you think this should be handled. Should we be worried about foreigners owning our ports, and what should the administration do?
If we're worried about foreigners being involved in operations in our ports, we have a lot to worry about. And I think one of the things that struck me, I didn't know, the degree to which most of the people operating, doing the operational work in our ports is our foreign countries, from foreign countries. And the reason is that most of the shipping in the world is done by ships of other countries' flags. So the ship operators want to operate the terminals where their stuff is unloaded and so on. Now, that's not the same thing as the security. That is looked after by the Customs and the Coast Guard. But I hope that the Dubai controversy will generate a lot more effort to secure our ports. I don't feel that enough is being done. But we can't just say no foreigners involved in our ports. That would be ridiculous. We'd shut them all down. And but we have to look to the security ourselves. I guess the way the Dubai thing has been playing, it's going to get itself resolved by the sale in some fashion or the removal of Dubai's direct management. So maybe that's the best we can do. But I always look for silver linings and things, and I think one of them is maybe it's a good wake-up call for us to be a little more careful and more scrutiny and more effort, more resources plowed in to this area.
Thank you. You spoke in your remarks about the need for democracy in the Middle East and several times about the importance of the role of women. But several of our listeners have asked the question, in the promotion of democracy in the Middle East, we have seen the election of Hamas. We have seen Islamist radicals elected in Egypt and in Afghanistan.
They weren't elected in Egypt, but they got a lot of
local warlords come to power. So the question is, can we trust to democracy in pursuing American interests in the Middle East? Do you feel confident of this process?
Well, I think that we're going to be better off almost always by having open governments and governments that are responsive to the people. If you look at what authoritarian governments have done, it's appalling. So we need to open things up, and we need to do it, as I said, not having just political openness in mind, but economic openness and economic progress. If all we do is create a situation where there are elections and there's poverty and no sense of progress, we're not going to get very far. They have to go together. Now, in the Hamas case, it's a fascinating case in many ways. They actually didn't get the most votes. They were more skillful at politicizing than their opposition was. The opposition fragmented itself, and so Hamas won the most seats. But I think it is a reality that there are a huge number of people in the Palestinian movement who think the way Hamas does. And we have to remember they are being financed by Iran, as Hezbollah is. And Iran has the same view that Hamas does. So it seems to me we need to point this out. My own sense is that you should deal with your enemies. I was never one to think that because you don't like somebody, you should refuse to deal with them. It's a question of what you say. And I see no reason at all why we should be financing them. Zero. So we just have to see. And in the meantime, Israel is having a disengagement policy carried out. A security barrier that has been erected apparently is working reasonably well. And so Israel is basically saying, we're going to get security as best we can by the actions we take rather than negotiations that we can't do with the opposite party. And we just have to wait and see what may take place. But I don't think it's an indictment of democracy that somebody you don't like gets elected. It sometimes even happens in this country. Not for me, but for other people.
Many people in the audience admire your diplomatic skill and would like to hear more about Iran and North Korea. There were a number of cards submitted asking, what would you do now to handle the proliferation challenges presented by Iran and North Korea?
Well, first of all, I think the subject that I mentioned of trying to get developed in the world a regime that gets control of the uranium enrichment process is a very important thing to do, and it affects all kinds of things, including the difficulties on balance, I'm for it, but there are difficulties that arise from the India deal. But if we could get a worldwide enrichment process going, control of that, I think it would help all around. On Iran, I think people are doing probably the best they can. And it's very important to inject into the picture with Iran the idea that there are consequences. That's been the problem. If you're trying to conduct diplomacy and the other side sees they can do anything they want and there are no consequences, you're not going to get very far. So I don't get alarmed to hear people say, you know, it's not true that we can't rough up their production facilities. We can. And they should bear that in mind. And they could feel a big economic push. We could, too, if their oil stops. So it's a dicey business. But you have to put some strength behind the diplomacy if you're going to succeed. And every time it looks like there's some strength and the countries are pulling together, Iraq sounds more reasonable. You just see it all the time. With North Korea, I think the six-party talks are the right approach, and we just have to keep at it and at it and at it. In the end, I hope that we'll succeed because, among other things, China. This is all these cases show you. You have to work with other people. You're not going to get anywhere. And so, if you look at the North Korea situation, you know the country with the most stroke is China. And so, what's the angle with China? Well, I think the angle is, if North Korea winds up with nuclear weapons on the end of ballistic missiles that they've already fired across Japan, what do you think Japan is going to do? And must be China's worst nightmare, a rearmed Japan with nuclear weapons. So they have a lot at stake, and they can do things. And we have to also say, and I've a lot of my South Koreans, they're the greatest students of what happened in Germany when it was unified. Nobody knows as much about it as they do. And they say, we can't handle that. We don't have the money to handle that. So I think we have to say that if that begins to happen, we're with you. We're there. We're going to help. You're not alone. And we could see something better start to emerge on the Korean Peninsula potentially. That's what we have to work for.
You have spent many years working on the challenge of dealing with the Russians. We used to call them the Soviets. And we face today significant policy challenges in dealing with Russia. Based on your experience, your extensive time negotiating with your Russian counterparts, how would you advise the administration deal today with a Russia that seems to be backsliding in a number of the important reforms that were undertaken in the 90s?
First of all, I think our relationship with Russia is extremely important. And we should have very energetic diplomacy with Russia. I hear people say, oh, Russia's the size of the Netherlands. Nonsense. It's the biggest piece of geography in the world, and it has the greatest storehouse of weapons of mass destruction and precursors of anybody in the world, let alone the oil. So you better pay attention and work at it and work at it and work at it. Get an agenda. Try to work it through. That's the way I would go about it. But I think you go about it also by being candid and frank about what you believe. I remember when Ronald Reagan said that the Soviet Union was an evil empire, and people went wild. I had a colleague, a wonderful man named Paul Nitze, I was working with. He'd worked in both Democratic and Republican administrations. And after the president said that, he was testifying, and the senators were all after him about how what about this? And I remember one, I think it was Senator Levin, who said to him, Paul, how can you serve in an administration where the president would call the Soviet Union an evil empire? And Paul looked at him and said, Senator, have you considered the possibility that the statement might be accurate? Sort of ended the hearing. But I think we have to say, not in an aggressive way, but we have to be willing to say what we believe and have the reality. You have to be dealing with reality and not with some thing you wish would happen. And that's the way we need to deal with the Russians and engage and understand them. And I think that progress can be made, but that's the way you have to do it.
A number of our listeners this evening admire you as a distinguished economic thinker in addition to your legacy as a diplomat, and would like to know your assessment about the American economy. Are you worried about it? Are you worried about the trade deficit? Are you worried about the budget deficit? And what do you think should be done about them?
Well, the American economy is going great. It is a wonder of the world. Just think, for over two decades now, we've had only six down quarters. This sustained growth is a staggering accomplishment. And inflation has been, ever since Ronald Reagan got it under control, it stayed under control. And I think there's every prospect that will continue to be the case. We have huge assets. We have a much more mobile-type economy than anybody else does. It can accommodate shifts. And so we have we're seeing a very good situation. There are all sorts of problems. One of the things that's, I don't understand just why it's so, but it's true, that in the last few years, real wages have not risen. So why is that? I'm not sure. I know the answer to that, but that's a problem. We have a deficit in our trade account in a sense that it's too big. On the other hand, if that deficit wasn't there, the world economy would be in a catastrophic shape because everybody else is living off our deficit. That's where they're... I mean, look at what would happen to China if we didn't have a deficit. What would happen to Germany if we didn't have this deficit? I'm not advocating the deficit, but I'm saying I believe it will start coming under control, but I hope it's gradual because it would be too hard on other countries, not ourselves. So we have plenty of problems. I think the biggest problem we have in our economy is our, so far, inability to face up to the huge potential costs of the entitlement programs, the income support and the health care that's out there, and promises are being made all over the place that when you add them up, add up to something that's just not going to be possible. So we have to face up to it and do something about it. And the political process so far seems unable to do it. It's happening right and left in the private sector, where there's a bottom line that forces action. But the political process has been kicking it down the road, but we've got to face up to it.
We've come to the time for our last question, and I'm going to exploit the prerogative of the chair to ask you one of my own. I want to read you a quote from Secretary Shultz's memoir, Turmoil and Triumph, and then ask you a question about it. He wrote, "From all my prior experience, I appreciated how important it is to see people on their own turf. where they feel at home and where you meet the people with whom they work. I call this kind of work gardening, and it is one of the most underrated aspects of diplomacy. The way to keep weeds from overwhelming you is to deal with them constantly and in their early stages. This is such a wise piece of advice, and I'd like to ask you to close this evening with telling us, where do we need to be doing more gardening around the world?
We need to be gardening everywhere. That is, we have to operate a global diplomacy like no other country. Personally, I believe your foreign policy starts in your neighborhood, with Canada, with Mexico, with Central America, Latin America, the Caribbean. So you got to pay a lot of attention. And I might say those people respond to attention, in my experience. The first trip I took out of the country as Secretary of State was to Canada. And with all that was going on, when I had a little press conference on the plane, the reporters all said, "What in the hell are you doing going to Canada?" And I said, "Well, who do you think is our biggest trading partner?" They all said Japan. I said, "Who's next?" "Germany." I said, "You're not even close. Canada is so far bigger than either of those countries, it's not even close." And my second one was to Mexico. So I think we need to be engaging energetically, and I said globally, and by that, I think what that implies is that we have to have a really larger and much improved foreign service, because we need heavyweights that can go out around the world. And we also need to pay a lot of attention to our ambassadorial corps. People don't realize how important ambassadors are. They are on the front line. They are the boots on the ground, and they're doing the representing. And the better job they do, the better able we are to get our points across, and the better able we are to understand what it is that's bugging the other guy. And that's one reason why I think this idea of trying to get some small consulates out around. I hate to see consulates being closed, because they are people who are out there. Usually it's Foreign Service officers. They speak the language. And they understand what these pieces of information are really all about. Somebody sitting in Washington with no feel of it can go very badly wrong. So I think gardening, as I said, is the most underrated activity, and it's extremely important to do. And if you go someplace, not because you've got some big issue or problem or you want to get them to do something, but just because you want to understand them better and have them understand you better. And one other thing, I used to have a practice of wherever I went, if I had the time, to go see something that the people in that country considered to be very important to them. And that was worth two ministerial meetings in terms of the impact you make in the country, because people think you're interested and that you particularly are interested in something they think is pretty good about themselves. So gardening is important.
Thank you. On behalf of the Commonwealth Club of California, we want to extend our deepest thanks to George Shultz, former United States Secretary of State and distinguished fellow at the Hoover Institution, for joining us. We also want to thank everyone in our audience for being here. And now this program of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.